Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi everyone, welcome to Downside History. This week, 80 years ago, it was all happening. The Dunkirk evacuation was in full swing. The so-called miracle of Dunkirk, when British naval vessels and small ships from all across southern and eastern England gathered to lift an entrapped British and French army off the North French coast around the port of Dunkirk. It was all this week. We've been running podcasts about it. We've had Josh Levine talking about Dunkirk. He was the historical advisor to the recent Christopher Nolan film. We've had Guy Bowman talking about a group of Indian Muslim soldiers who found themselves caught up in the evacuation. And today we're going to reprise an old episode from a couple of years ago on this podcast when I accepted the invitation of the wonderful Ian Gilbert, who is in charge of the Little Ships Association. He's one of the people keeping the memory of Dunkirk alive and keeping the ships that took part in that evacuation, keeping them afloat and with good owners and in good condition. I accepted an invitation. I went down to the River Thames at Windsor and we went for a little trip on some of the little ships. And I met some veterans as well. I met Edward Oates, who you're going to hear from, William Matthews, Stanley Chappell, Arthur Taylor. Sadly, William and Arthur are now deceased. It was only a couple of years ago that I was lucky enough to meet them and hear their stories. In this episode, you'll hear from all of those people. You'll hear memories of what it was like on the beach and what it was like coming back in the little ships 80 years ago. Sadly, every 5 years, all the little ships that are still able to go back to Dunkirk, and I've made that journey twice with them now. We're meant to do it again this year, but it's been rescheduled for next year. History Hit will be there. We'll be filming, we'll be podcasting, we'll be live streaming, we'll be in drones, we'll be doing the whole thing. So look forward to doing that. If you like listening to these back episodes of the podcast, they're only available on History Hit TV. It's like Netflix for history. There's hundreds of documentaries, but there's also lots of back episodes of the podcast exclusively available there. We really appreciate your support. It's what keeps us all going. You guys are subscribing to History Hit and you're making it possible for us to go on making all this content, and we're getting better and more ambitious all the time. If you use the code POD1, P-O-D-1, you get a month for free, and then you get 1 month for just £1, euro or dollar. We've got a new film up about Dunkirk. We've got a film about the fall of France coming. We got stuff about the Titanic coming and about global pandemics. We're in full flow, even though we're operating under lockdown conditions. But thank you to everyone for your support. Enjoy this episode about the little ships and the men they rescued.
I'm so lucky to be sat here now. I think it's fantastic to see this lovely, smiling Berkshire countryside with the Thames so placid and the cerulean sky. I'm so lucky.
Did you think you'd be seeing this ever again when you were on the beaches at Dunkirk back in 1940?
There are many occasions in the First World War, in the Second World War, when I didn't think I might live the next second, let alone 10 years or 20 years or 30 years. I thought I was highly likely not to live very long. I've seen the bombs coming down like pebbles out of the sky from Stukas diving on us, and the next second I thought this one's coming, and then it would veer off and my mouth would be full of tingling sensation by the enzymes that were floating around my body. And I really thought I wasn't going to live very long. And that has been replicated on many occasions in that war. So I'm so lucky when so many of my friends didn't make it. And
how did you come to be in Dunkirk? Did you have to walk back there?
My battery, El Neri battery, was supporting the 3rd Division of Brigadier Montgomery, who later led the first battle of the Second World War for us to win we retreated, and I remember looking up into the sky and seeing the whole German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, thousands and thousands of planes droning on. And they were so lucky not to pay us any attention. They were going off to bomb Dunkirk and the ports, the French ports. And so we retreated, yes. And to cut a long story short, very, very short, we finished up on a hilltop called Monde Shah, which was 50 or 60 miles away from east of Dunkirk, and we had one gun left. I wasn't a gunner in those days. I was a gunnery officer's assistant, but I watched our last gun firing over open sights at the Germans, who were down below, about 1,000 yards away, I should say. And then the order came that we were to destroy our guns and make our way to Dunkirk, where the Navy would pick us up. So our last gun was destroyed by putting a shell up the breech and one down the muzzle, and then detonating it and blew the gun up. And then we come under very heavy fire, and I remember getting up onto the main road and seeing a truck come by, and Trevor Luff, a friend of mine, said, "Jump," and I jumped onto it, and that was the last road out before being sealed off by the German army. And we made our way until some Messerschmitts decided to pay us attention and came strafing the road, and the road was blocked up with refugees and of all kinds and sorts of descriptions. We just dived into the ditches, and when they'd gone, we were left walking. But then a section of French cavalry came by, and they were leading quite a lot of horses. And being an ex-Royal Horse Artillery man, I signalled, could I ride one of the horses? And they said yes. So I jumped on a horse, and my friend Bert Reed jumped on a horse as well, and we rode along with the cavalry for about 20 miles, I suppose. And then they decided to switch off and go south, and we wanted to continue going west and northwest. So we said thanks very much and handed back the reins, and we were left walking. But then I noticed there was a nice motorbike in a courtyard, and I looked into, there was petrol in the tank, so I tickled the carburetor and started up. It worked perfectly. So I said, jump on the pillion, Bert. And then we rode on for quite some time on this motorbike. But then we came across a crossroad that was coming under heavy enemy fire. But it was a bit intermittent. But I didn't like the look of crossing that crossroads because I'd read a book where people had to do that sort of thing, and it didn't end very nicely. So at any rate, I looked in the carburetor and it was nearly empty, so I said to Bert, we'll have to walk on from now. And so we did. We went across the open fields, and I had a map which was a print out of the Daily Mirror, and we did a bit of orienteering with this. And eventually we came to Dunkirk, which was in the evening. You didn't need a map to get to Dunkirk because the columns of smoke were going sky high here, and it was just a question of following that. And by the time we got into Dunkirk, all the bombing had stopped because it was night time, and we made our way down onto the beach, and there we saw hundreds of bodies laying out with blankets over them. So I really thought, surely they aren't all dead. And then suddenly one of the blankets was pulled back, and a voice said, "What's the time, mate?" It was some members of the Guards Brigade, and they were having a good old doze. So we walked on and eventually came to the dunes. The next day, it was absolutely... We tried to... There were people queuing into queues to be taken off, but we were very unlucky. We couldn't get out, couldn't be taken off. And it became more hazardous by the hour because the debris was so dense that motor boats who had propellers daren't come in, or the propellers would get enmeshed in the rubbish that was littering the surface of the sea. So I said to my friend, I said, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to build a raft to get to ferry us out beyond this 100 or 200 yards of rubbish, and then we'll get picked up. So he said, okay. So we set to work and we built a raft, and nobody bothered to say, what are you doing, or anything. And the problem was we didn't have nails or a hammer, so most of it we had to tie them together with ropes that we'd found lying around. So we built this raft, and then we found it was so heavy we couldn't push it for love nor money. And it was about 3 or 4 yards off the beach, off the water. So I said, so I looked around, and I saw under the sea wall was a Brengen carrier. So it was about 250 yards away. So I went over to it, jumped in, pressed the key, and it bursted to life right away, no problem. So I drove it back around, positioned it in front of the raft, we tied it on, and I said, now, when I go out, give me the yell when it's floating, and I'll cut the engine. So I drove the Brown Gun carrier into the water, and until I couldn't drive it any further, and it went on for a long time, even though it was underwater. which was amazing, really. But when it finally stopped and I looked around, the raft was floating beautifully. So we cut it free, and we put our clothes onto the raft, and then we pushed it out through the debris and paddled it out, oh, I should say 300 or 400 yards, until we were clear of all the rubbish. But by that time, the wind had been getting up, and a swell began to break, and the raft, being built out of spars with rope, they all became loose, and gradually they floated away, and we were left swimming in the water. And I swam around, and the place was covered with oil from sunken ships and from their tanks. And then the next thing I knew, there was a big motorboat had pulled in, and they were pulling me into the boat. They pulled me into the boat, and as soon as I was into the boat, they shot off out to a large mother boat that had been anchored about a kilometre off, out of range of the Messerschmitts and the Stukas that were bombing it at the time. And I walked up the slanting bridge, the walkway onto the ship, and somebody gave me an overcoat, and that was how I left Dunkirk.
What was it like getting home?
Brilliant. It was marvellous. I hadn't had any food for some time because the food was a bit scarce to come by on. And so sat down, and they brought me a lovely mug of navy cocoa, and that was one of the best drinks I've ever had in my life. It was gorgeous. I really was like nectar. And then the next thing I knew was somebody saying, pull on this rope. That was pulling the anchors up and pulling the boats on because they were fearing of being sunk any moment by planes coming over. So that's how I left Dunkirk. And, of course, I went to sleep. The next thing I knew was it Margate, wasn't it? Yeah, at Margate, not Ramsgate, Margate.
And what's your name?
Edward Oates.
How old are you, sir?
97.
And what were you doing in May and June of 1940?
May and June? Waiting for a boat, I think.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I'm looking for answers to the big questions about every aspect of life in the early modern period. Like, how did the memory of Anne Boleyn continue to influence the court of her daughter, Elizabeth I? How were fairies brought to life on the Elizabethan stage? And how did the arrival of male-only doctors threaten the lives of women? In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Subscribe now and follow me on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected, digital picture frames. that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when you use a messaging app, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage. Add unlimited photos and videos and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's A-U-R-A-Frames.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
So you were with the BF. What unit were you in?
I was in the 9th Army Field Workshop, ROC.
And how long were you waiting in that perimeter before you got off the beach?
It was 5 or 6 days, I think it was. I don't remember just exactly how long. All we had to do was looking for food.
And what do you remember about those days?
Not a lot. I've got all the photographs, so I see the photographs, and that brings some of it back.
Were you on the mole waiting to get evacuated, or were you on the beach?
On the beach at Bray Dunes. And then we walked from Bray Dunes into Dunkirk eventually after a few days when we weren't getting away.
And was it well organised, or were things getting a little ragged by that stage?
I don't know. I was worried as soon as I got off.
And so in the end, did you get off on a naval ship or one of the little ships?
One of the little ships. Yes.
So did you waded out to sea, or how did it work?
No, well, we walked into Dunkirk and got on the docks. So I didn't have to go in, wade into the sea. We did wade into the sea before. We never managed to get on anything. So we had to come back to the beach. But eventually, when we got into Dunkirk, we got on the boat. But I tell you what, my boots polished up ever so shiny because they'd been in the seawater thoroughly wet for days.
And how many of you were on one of these little boats?
I don't know.
Was it packed?
Fairly, yes. He took as many as he could.
Did you think, this is it, we must have lost the war, or did you think you'd be back in Europe soon to take on Hitler?
I didn't think anything about it. I was worried about getting off.
And what was it like getting home?
Oh, it was all right.
You must have been happy, though, seeing Kent.
Yeah, I was happy enough, yeah.
What, on the crossing, was there any danger from German aircraft or any of that?
No, I was asleep. And when I woke up, it was grey, misty dawn, and we finished up in Folkestone. And that's all I remember of it.
What did you do for the rest of the war?
The Middle East. I was in army workshops, field workshops.
What does it mean coming back here, seeing all these boats alongside today? Do you love coming back and seeing these and meeting up with some of your old comrades?
Yeah, if I see any of them, but there are not many of them left now. I think there's only me and George in our Dunkirk club that we're in. All the others are supporters. All hangers on.
So what's your name, sir?
William Matthews, Bill for friends.
Well, Bill, if I may. What were you doing at Dunkirk? Were you an infantryman?
Infantryman. I was setting up in the sandhills. We come off the beach, went back in the sandhills at the side of the beach for safety.
And why was that? Was it artillery or German air attacks that were the problem?
It was the Stukas. And then they could see us. So I had a stomach like a little white billiard ball. And Nobby Clark beside me said, I told you not, or I was upset, and he said, and they rocket down, I can strike down, and then as I turn, saw the machine gun the beach. But there's been worse things than when we got there. I come from Brussels to get down there, and while we were in Brussels, we found some papers. If you waved them to somebody, they would take you prisoner, lay down your arms, and you go back. Because all the regiments are moved back, but they left a couple of platoons of guys to keep an eye on the people down there and report back. And the Warwickshire Regiment, there was 88 blokes. They went over with them and give in. And our sergeant said, and you think of giving in, he said, you've got to go through me. Anyway, we moved from Brussels across country to get to the seaside. And we found out afterwards that they executed the 88 Warwicks.
Wow.
Yeah, and when we got back home and told them, oh, look, the war is over now. Don't want to worry about things like that. And so it's like we've been striped trousers, isn't it?
So what was it like being under German air attack? Did you feel completely helpless?
Yeah, we couldn't do anything. I had my face in the sand, and instead of having a stomach, it was like a billiard ball.
Were you hungry as well and tired?
Well, 2 days we'd been on the road, and we had no food. And then the Ben McCree, that's an all-a-man steamer, came in, and he came in the groin side. The groin side, the water was deep, but this side, the water went out about a mile. And she backed into there, we got aboard her, and they grabbed you by the equipment and held you and sling you aboard. I woke up in Folkestone, and I don't know where I was. I know there were thousands of chaps there, and then big marquee, thousands of new Dixies. I went and got 2 dinners, and I am. And when I finished those 2, I had a couple of puddings and all. And when that was Saturday night, 8:30, and next minute somebody's kicking me, and it's a sergeant sitting on your feet. It was Sunday, 12:30. Slept out on the grass all night. And the regiment had gone down to Somerset.
When you were in Dunkirk hiding, how long were you hiding in those sand dunes in Dunkirk waiting for a ride off that beach?
Oh, a day and a half. We were so disappointed in one place. We'd come along and we'd been told we were going to a place called Dunkirk, so you'd be all right, it's a seaport. We come round the corner and there was a Normandy ship blazing from stem to stern. We said we're here. We won. When we got near it, it was brick built. It was a hotel. So we give that the bounce and then we still carried on down the road.
And you'd walked all retreating all the way. Were you disillusioned? Were you feeling down or did you keep spirits up?
Oh no, Clark and the rest of them and Honey, they come on, Matt, pick your feet up. And for 2 days we walked down the outside because we had to get from Brussels. But we didn't know at the time that we were going the wrong way. The Germans had come in the Brussels, and they were, we was in the palace. And a Frenchman come over, he said that the Germans are coming through there. So we said, let's get out of it then. There's no idea. They had tanks. There was 31 of us, and there was big tanks. And I carried an anti-tank rifle, bullets that long. And I'm supposed to lay out in the middle of the road, and as the tank comes towards me, line him up, and then fire at him. That's the point of the gun. It wouldn't, there was a boat like this, laying on its side, smoking all over everywhere. So the COE said, sink that bloody thing. And he fired. They ricocheted off.
Just bounced off.
Yeah. He said, give me the gun. And he slung it. And at that moment, I was standing by Captain Ricketts, and he gave, there was a big bang, a couple of big bangs near us, and he went down, and I looked at him. When I went down, he got a wicked wound up here. So I grabbed him and told the other blokes, and they hauled him on his feet, and he got dirt, all tufts of grass in it. And we can only imagine that it was we don't know what it was really. And we took him to the base where they got all this. They said, leave him with us, we'll take care of him. And we went back. And then afterwards, when I was at the Star and Garter, went up there to a do. He was standing over there, and I walked over, and he said, don't I know you? I said, yeah, I'm the bloke me and the 2 hours are taking you to the hospital, and he's you're over. But then everybody moved out, so we didn't know what happened to him. And he was back in England then, and there he was alive.
You saved his life.
No, I wouldn't say that. Somebody would have found him. And
but what do you remember from those sand dunes? Were there dead and wounded lying around in those sand dunes from the air attacks?
Oh, there's quite a lot. Those air attacks, when those Stukas come down, straight down there, and when you look up, you can see the green bomb fall away, and you get deeper in the dirt. I wished I was a mole so I could dig a hole, or a white billiard ball down here is the stomach. Cocky said to me, we've been upset this lot like we have. Because then, once they come out the dive, they machine gun them. But they were doing the beach, most of the beach, but we was up the shelf part where the long grass was.
Was it every man for himself, or were men still obeying their officers and were still the military discipline?
We did what the sergeant said. Lieutenant Brooks Fox was our lieutenant of our platoon. And whenever he did anything, he used to say, the sergeant and I, the sergeant 34, we're going to do so-and-so. So whatever the sergeant said, we did it.
And how did you get off the beach?
On the horizon, the water, there's a long groin, and one side of the groin, the water went out about 6 feet, all the way out. Big boats couldn't get in. So I had hundreds of little boats coming in. But I didn't fancy wading out on my dress like. And you can't run anywhere in the water. So the sergeant said, let's get back in on the top of the beach in the sand dunes with the long grass. And when they must have seen us, they dropped a couple, but they nowhere near us. And it's just sand goes up in the air, terrific noise. Frightens the daylight out of it, it does. You got a gun like a white billiard ball, and I wish I was a mole. And bleeding cock, he turns around and says, we've upset him, mate. He said, we've asked for this.
And then, so when did you, which boat did you eventually manage to get off the beach on?
The Ben McCree. It was an Isleman steamer. There's eight of them, and this was one of them.
The plane was a bit noisy, sorry. So can I ask that again, because the plane was a bit noisy. So what boat did you get off the beach on?
Ben McCree. Ben McCree. And after the war, I wrote to the Isle of Man's last name and said thank you very much. And they sent me a booklet and first-class stamps and all stuff like that, yeah.
So you got off on one of the little ships of Dunkirk?
Yeah. Well, you'd say it was a little ship. It was big to me.
And how were there guys packed in there, standing room only?
I don't know. I started climbing up the side, and then Matlow leaned over, grabbed me by the equipment, heaved me in, and the next one. And on the deck I went, and I woke up in Folkestone. That's all I know of the crossing. We'd been on the road all the way from Brussels. There's no food. And everything like that, we just kept going. And the sergeant, he kept us going. Nobody ran or anything like that. He used to walk up and down. He must have done it twice, the sergeant. But Brook Fox...
So he'd walk up and down the unit, making sure everyone was...
Yeah. And terrible part was Monte Cassino. Brook Fox was the first bloke killed. He took a unit out and walked into a net trap. Yeah, it was Brook Fox. He was a captain then.
Well, thank you very much. Have a great day today.
I will.
So we're underway now. We're pottering along the River Thames on a nice sunny day in June. It's hard to imagine. You've taken us across the channel, though. I mean, it's a different challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed. This is proper pleasure boating. Present company accepted, of course. No, it's a beautiful day at Windsor, and the water's flat. Completely different to the experience of crossing the channel, where in a 26-foot boat, put it this way, we wouldn't do it for pleasure, probably, only if we needed to.
What's interesting is every time one of us moves from one side of the boat to the other, the whole boat moves. So I don't quite know how that works with a load of soldiers on board in rough channel conditions.
Yeah, indeed. And I don't think anybody would want to cross the channel with a load of soldiers on under any circumstances. Certainly when Firefly was at Dunkirk, we had an eyewitness account of the first thing that the skipper did, having loaded the boat up with men, and there was only five or six on board for a shuttle run out to HMS Anthony. First thing he did was level them all up and order them around and get them in the right place, because it just makes it incredibly uncomfortable. You lean in and the boat doesn't go in a straight line, and it's not pleasant. She's very very sensitive to the way she's loaded.
I feel the happy history of my show.
The history of our country.
hope you enjoyed the podcast. Just before you go, bit of a favour to ask. I totally understand if you don't want to become a subscriber or pay me any cash money. Makes sense. But if you could just do me a favour, it's for free. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. If you give it a 5-star rating and give it an absolutely glowing review, purge yourself, give it a glowing review. I'd really appreciate that. It's a tough world out there. Law of the jungle out there. And I need all the fire support I can get. So that will boost it up the charts. It's so tiresome. But if you could do it, I'd be very, very grateful. Thank you.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Shopify helps you sell at every stage of your business. Like that, let's put it online and see what happens stage.
And the site is live.
That we opened a store and need a fast checkout stage.
Thanks, you're all set.
That count it up and ship it around the globe stage.
This one's going to Thailand.
And that, wait, did we just hit 1 million orders stage? Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History Hit. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.